Welcome back to another episode of the Front Page Football Podcast. It has been a couple of weeks and I'm back on the pod. Your host, Christian Marchetti here. And tonight I am joined by only one guest. We've gone only for the two tonight, hoping maybe for some more in-depth discussion, maybe less tangents, although I can't promise anything because it's Matt Olson who is with me, the king of the tangent. Matt, how are we doing tonight?
Yeah, well, you know that scene I'm kidding. It's a pleasure to be here. Of course, the A-League will only be about a month away now. So very exciting.
Yeah, very, very exciting. In fact, actually, so we're recording this on Tuesday, the 17th of September, Tuesday night. The Mariners are actually playing right now in the Asian Champions League Elite. They're actually 1-1 against Shandong Luneng. We might even have some you can get our little reactions maybe if the Mariners were to get a second goal and win that, that'd be awesome. But basically tomorrow, from when we're recording right now, would mark exactly 1 month till the A-League men's season starts because it's October 18th. So very much in that period where, although we're kind of in a bit of a dry period football wise, we still have the Australia Cup reaching its climax, and then straight after that we're going to have basically 2 weeks to lead into the A-League's season. So very, very exciting. So I'm going to start off by, like we did in the last pod, just going through what's happened essentially in the world of Australian football since our last podcast. So first of all, A-League's transfer news. We're going to start off with A-League men, of course, yesterday. Now I don't really know if it's like a thing, but like the A-League transfer window closed yesterday. But it feels like a kind of null and void thing to mention, given that like free agents can still be signed and, you know, players can kind of still be mutually terminated from contracts and just join. But anyway, we'll get into some of those transfers now. So a few of these happened yesterday, a few of these happened a bit more recent. So Auckland, we'll start with them. They've announced a trio of foreign signings. The Uruguayan forward, Guillermo May, the Chilean Luis Felipe Gallegos, and the Belgian Luis Verstrait. I don't know if I've butchered any one of those. I have not had the best track record when it comes to foreign pronunciations on the podcast of late, but I think those were decent. But yeah, Auckland dipping into their transfer kitty, I guess, and signing a few foreigners. Melbourne City, they've brought back Nathaniel Atkinson. He's returned. And they've also signed the Israeli international Yonatan Cohen. Brisbane Roar, they made a very, very interesting signing yesterday, signing the Indonesian striker Rafael Struik, which was met with some incredible social media engagement. I believe that the Roar's Instagram following went up by something like 20,000 in literally like a matter of hours, given the Indonesian manic sort of fanfare around Struik and that signing. And of course, how can we not mention it? Probably should have been the first one I mentioned, but Juan Mata, which we talked about in the last pod being linked with a move, but that's obviously now been confirmed. He is the Western Sydney Wanderers' marquee signing, and he's arrived already in Australia to some much fanfare. Pretty awesome scenes, actually, at Sydney Airport to greet him on his arrival, and he's already started training as well, which is a really good sign. Hopefully he can get fit and can play a meaningful role for the Wanderers this season. Now, Matt, your boys, Perth Glory, over out west, they made a couple of Ecuadorian signings. The winger, Christian Caicedo, the defender, Lewis Kanga as well. Kanga's right, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or is it, it's not a Changa or a Sanga or anything?
No. Wouldn't be. Wouldn't pronounce the C that way.
No.
Just now that I'm thinking about it, Caicedo, who you mentioned, is he not Colombian? Or have I got?
Is
that?
He not? He
played in the second tier of Colombia. I'm almost certain he's Colombian, but that,
I'm
you know what?
Pretty.
You know what? It's fine.
You know what? It's fine. But I am pretty positive he is Ecuadorian, as I only actually looked this up. Like literally, no, he's Colombian. He's Colombian. I've got that totally, totally wrong. Caicedo is Colombian. I support Chelsea. They have a player called Caicedo who is Colombian. Linda Caicedo as well. Caicedo is a Colombian surname. Well done, Christian. Okay, moving on. MacArthur, they've been busy. A very interesting subplot to their Australia Cup semi-final, which we're going to talk about way later down the track in this podcast, is Harry Sawyer has joined them from South Melbourne. And they've also signed the Belgian defender, Dino Arslanagic. Possibly feels like slight butchering, but we'll take it.
Doesn't sound right when you say it how it's spelled, does it?
Yeah, it doesn't. When you pronounce it phonetically, it always just kind of sounds wrong, but then sometimes it's actually right. Yeah, MacArthur making a couple of deals there. The Jets have got a couple of deals over the line. They've been linked for quite a while, actually, to the Brazilian Welesol, the 26-year-old. They finally got that one over the line. They've also signed Ben Gibson, the youngster from RPL Leichhardt, who had a really good season in the NPL. Speaking of signings from the NPL New South Wales, the Wanderers have dipped into the local market. They've added James Temelkovski from Marconi and also Dean Pelicanos from Rockdale and Linden, two teams that, of course, made the grand final in New South Wales, the NPL. And their arch rivals, Sydney FC, loaned in the Polish striker Patrick Klamala, again another player that has had that was hunted for quite a while by Sydney FC. And the final one I'll mention here, and he's actually playing for the Mariners right now, is Sabit Nur, who joined the Mariners from Heidelberg United recently as well. Matt, a lot of transfer news as expected, given that the window just closed, the domestic window. What do you reckon in terms of those signings? What catches your eye there?
Yeah, look, just from the top down, as it were, Auckland, you know, those guys, you don't really know how they're going to blend in with that team. I mean, you don't know how even the more familiar names in that team are going to blend in with each other, right? So you just have to kind of push that one aside and kind of wait for the first few rounds to really see the impact of a lot of those players. I feel like Gervais Trat is someone that I have actually seen around somewhere. I don't know what club he would have played for that I'm familiar with. Genuinely might just be from like a FIFA save or something. So I don't want to speak too highly on that. But yeah, no, the name actually brings out to me. So it's an interesting one. Nathaniel Atkinson, obviously, maybe not had the longevity of his career in Scotland that he was looking for, but a reliable pair of hands, or should that be pair of feet, for Melbourne City.
He needs those hands for throw-ins, doesn't he? So maybe a pair of hands.
Look, the Wanmata one is obviously, it just is appealing, but you also have to kind of look at it on paper and think there could be injury concerns. There could be other things down the line where it just doesn't work. And when a signing is this big for the competition, you almost want to get a little bit worried. The one thing I'll say is, and again, I know that, you know, we can have a track record of really getting caught up in it, but the way he speaks about it does just seem a little bit more switched on than certain foreign names that have been here. And I say that in the sense that he's gone out of his way to mention, you know, they're a club that's won the Asian Champions League. The Asian Champions League is a competition that won, you know, has had an eye on playing for Kobe, winning the J-League. So he's had that awareness. And obviously, they're not in the Champions League this season, but it's just that awareness of what the club has done in the past. And like, I feel like when you can tell when a signing is a flop, when they're not going to allude to that. They'll give you platitudes. They won't give you a piece of your own history in a way. So that was something that just kind of reached out to me as, okay, I think he genuinely does care about this. And he cares about transitioning from somewhere like Japan to testing his professional skills in Australia. But, you know, there's just going to be questions about his consistency. And if he gets on and has a good season, he has a good season. But yeah, I guess it's one that's almost too big for the competition. And the same can be said for Douglas Costa, but there's other conversations to have there. The Shrewick one, you know, I think it's a signing that's been so long in the making. Why we haven't gone for a really big Vietnamese, Thai, Indonesian name, I'll never really understand. And it's taken Indonesia, you know, quite literally taking points off the Socceroos, and then we get a signing like this. It's a little bit frustrating because I, as someone who follows Asian football, you know, that stuff was always there. The fandom and the ability to grow through that market was always there. Harry Sawyer stuff is funny, but yeah, we'll actually touch on it when we preview the teams. Well, Sol, you heard me kind of clicking my lips there as he read it out. The thing that just speaks out to me is this bizarre situation with Fabrizio Romano, and everyone just smashing them in the comments saying, you ordered him off Cameo, didn't you, Newcastle? Which is funny. It's just funny.
Wait, ordered him off what?
Cameo.
Okay, I'm going to show my boomer potential here. What's Cameo?
It's where you like you can get a celebrity to wish one of your mates like happy birthday or something.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, obviously that makes more sense than Newcastle literally getting in personal contact with Fabrizio Romano.
No.
Hey, Fabrizio, take some time out of your busy schedule where your screen time is like 17 hours a day.
Listen. I don't think they actually ordered a Cameo. That's fucking ridiculous. And also, it's notorious for not being timely. Like you can't order a Cameo and actually get it when you attend. The celebrities always take a while because, like, no shit. They're just in it for a quick buck. Like, anyway, I don't know where that was going.
So Fabrizio Romano using Cameo is a similar situation to Douglas Costa using OnlyFans or.
We're going there already. When I mentioned Costa, earlier, I specifically was like, I'm not going to mention it.
I was just making a joke, but please, let's not open the conversation further. You were saying, all right, you were talking about the Jets signings. Yeah, so you mentioned Welasol.
Welasol, again, Ben Gibson's solid. You know, all of these signings from the NPL, they typically step up. They can have a solid career, so... Yeah, it is what it is. Klamala was another one from Sydney who in his presser spoke about, you know, his desire to either want to continue in Europe or try a new challenge. And the agent reached out to him and said Australia. And he said, of course, me and my wife want to go live on the beach in Australia. Are you kidding? So again, just another foreign signing here. Okay, he's not even here on name recognition. So the principle that I was describing earlier might not apply. But again, it's just that intent. Like when they say that stuff, you can tell they have that gene in them to want to stick around for a few seasons. And then we have Ngor, as I said, he's starting wing back tonight in China, by all means, probably making a good account of himself. I guess we'll find out when we actually get to watch the game after. And yeah, look, another sort of busy closing to that transfer period, as it were. But I feel like with all of the budgetary concerns that we've had, it's going to be a COVID 2.0. We're actually going to get a weirdly good product and hopefully like in 2021, an unpredictable product as well. There's a lot here that should get normal A-League fans really, really excited.
Yeah. Just whilst you were talking, I looked up First Straight just to see. Mm. So he's just really only played in Belgium and he's been around the block in Belgium. So Ghent, Oostend, Royal Antwerp, few different clubs.
Play for the national team at all?
I should have actually looked that up. Hey, when you were talking, right. He's played. So he's only represented Belgium up to under 21 levels. So some of these guys who come in, some of these foreigners who have had youth, you know, level international experience, you can kind of see it still shine through when they're playing. Anything else, Matt, on that? We'll probably need to move on swiftly, but you were saying?
Well, yeah. No, just on Verstrat, I've done a FIFA career mode or an NEA career mode with Burshot, so that's literally what I know.
Twice you called it FIFA. How dare you?
Yeah, sorry. Anyways.
They're not sponsoring, so it's all right. It's all good.
Yep.
Yep. Okay. Now, in terms of some dub transfer news in the last couple of weeks. So, Canberra United have been busy. Good to see them getting some deals over the line and getting their team together and sorted. So, Janaya Dos Santos from Sydney FC, they've brought her in. It was a very interesting signing, I think. And also Liz Anton from Perth Glory. An interesting signing for Melbourne City. They've brought TJ Vlanic in from Western United. That felt like a kind of a, when I saw that, kind of a, whoa, that's kind of a big move. And also talking of teams or contenders making big moves, Sydney FC added Faye Bryson from the Central Coast Mariners to their mix. And in terms of departures, Michaela Foster departed the Wellington Phoenix, and that's to pursue an overseas opportunity, which I don't believe is known yet, Matt, or has that... Has it been announced? No, no. I was checking that before, and I didn't see anything. I was just checking if you had or not. But yeah, nothing there for Michaela Foster yet. But I'm sure that'll be announced very soon. I'm gonna move on now to some results that have happened in the past couple of weeks. So mainly recapping some NPL results. Obviously, seasons have now come to a close pretty much everywhere except for where you are, Matt. They've still got the Top Four Cup is concluding, I believe, and also in Canberra, they've got the grand final happening. Nope, I've got that wrong.
Sorry, there is a really big piece of news out of WA that I should have probably let you know to mention it on our run sheet, but we didn't get to it.
Look, I'm happy to let you mention it in a moment.
But, you mentioned Top Four Cup, but there's some gossip. Okay. But get going.
Okay. But main thing in terms of NPL Grand Final still to come is Canberra's, and that will be Canberra Croatia taking on Tigers FC this weekend. Elsewhere, talking about New South Wales, so one kind of A-League related result, which I thought was worth mentioning, Mariners Academy, they stayed up in the NPL New South Wales. They defeated MacArthur's Academy, also known as Bulls Academy, over two legs in the promotion relegation playoff, which is a very, very interesting result, I think. And also we saw Marconi, of course, defeat Rockdale 3-0 in the grand final at CommBank Stadium. It's their first championship since 2012, 12 years for Marconi is a bit of a drought. And they've also just become Rockdale's kryptonite in New South Wales. They beat him 9-0. They beat him 3-0. So, yeah, there's also been a bit of a, I want to say banterous, war of words between between the Marconi players and Rockdale players on social media about the weight of a championship versus the weight of a premiership, but that's kind of a commonplace in NPL circles on a yearly basis. And also, actually, one for you, Matt, Perth Glory's A-League women coach, Stephen Peters, he did lead MacArthur Rams to a third successive NPL W New South Wales championship. They defeated RPL Leichhardt in the final. So that's New South Wales. Over to Victoria. Oakley, speaking of kryptonites, Oakley are clearly South Melbourne's kryptonite because they once again defeated them in the NPL Victoria Grand Final 1-0. And Heidelberg defeated Preston in the NPLW Grand Final in what was quite a crazy game. If you have some time, go and check out the highlights of that one. There was a late winner, all sorts of chaos. In Queensland, Moreton City Excelsior, who have been one of the stories of the Australia Cup, they actually did lose the NPL Queensland Grand Final to Lions FC 1-0 in that game. And Lions FC actually, in doing that, secured the treble for 2024. They won the championship, they won the Queensland Cup, and they won the Kappa Pro Series in Queensland as well. And Brisbane City ended up claiming the NPLW Queensland Championship by actually defeating Lions FC's women's side in the grand final there. Both grand finals held at Suncorp Stadium. Now, where I am in South Australia, Michael Petrucciani, the new Melbourne City A-League women coach, he led Campbelltown City, which is, I guess, my local, only 15 minutes from me. He led them to the championship, their first NPLSA championship since 2020. They defeated the Metro Stars 3-1 in the grand final. A fantastic crowd as well at that game. Salisbury Inter defeated West Adelaide in the WNPL grand final in South Australia. If I'm not mistaken, that's their third championship in 4 years. It's quite a weird dynamic at Salisbury Inter. Their women's team is exceptional, yet their men's team is only entering the competitions next season. Very much a club which is heavily invested on their women's side. To Tasmania, this is definitely a story worth mentioning. We saw Glenorchy Knights claim the NPL Tasmania Premiership in what was a dramatic final day. Basically went down to three teams, Glenorchy, South Hobart, and Devonport on the final day. South Hobart won their game. They did their job. It was between Glenorchy and Devonport, who were playing each other at Glenorchy's ground, KGV. And Devonport had something like 30 shots in the game, and they couldn't find their way past this young goalkeeper for Glenorchy, who kept a clean sheet, and in doing so, also helped his team win the premiership, which is actually an incredible story. So if you get the chance, go and check it out. Really awesome story, that one. So Glenorchy, big silverware triumph for them. In Northern New South Wales as well, Broadmeadow Magic defeating Edgeworth Eagles on penalties in the grand final that happened this past weekend. Another really exciting final, that one as well. A lot of the NPL grand finals were entertaining in some way or another, which was really fantastic to see. Good for the product. And finally, on a national team level, the Oli Roos had a couple of good wins against Vanuatu's senior side in another one of those Pacific Oz sports series. Matt actually wrote about the Joey's Pacific Oz sports series. That's on the website, frontpagefootball.net, so you can go check that out. But yeah, 3-0 and 4-0 wins, which are really good to see. The Young Matildas, which we are going to talk about briefly later on, they unfortunately bowed out of the Under-20 Women's World Cup at the group stage. 0 points, 3 losses. Unfortunately, not the best campaign for Leah Blaney's team. And I thought I would also mention, just to kind of put a ribbon on this discussion, we also saw in the National Para Football Championships, the Football New South Wales representative team was crowned the champions there. And also, Matt, actually, Football West representative team finished second. They lost to New South Wales in the grand final. So interesting thing to mention there. So, yes, I know I've just been rambling for about 2 minutes there, but there's a lot of football that was ending at the start of September, and I just thought it was worth summing it up. Anything there, without mentioning obviously Young Matildas, because we are going to talk about that later, anything that stands out to you? And if you would like to, I'll let you do about 60 seconds on NPLWA.
Yeah, okay. So the Para, just by the way, the Para and the Power Chair Football are two really big programs at WA. Something we've always prided ourselves on is the inclusion. In terms of any of these sort of title battles and anything, I don't really have a lot of substance to add, but just out of NPLWA, this is a huge story, by the way. Fremantle City, I have a personal relationship with someone sort of higher up at Fremantle City, so I've got to be careful of how I word this. But basically, after a successful promotion campaign that was a really, really big story that kind of made waves within WA football, Fremantle City, a club that once famously bid for a spot in the A-League, made their way up, and under the stewardship of an incredible manager in the Englishman, Matt Sparrow, they finished third just behind Kingsway and off the top of my head.
I think it was in front of Stirling Macedonia. In front of Stirling Macedonia.
Was it Stirling in second? No, sorry.
So Fremantle City finished, they finished fourth.
Did they?
Yes.
I thought they were in third. They might have
just
been
behind, just behind Stirling Macedonia. And obviously Perth Red Star second.
Red Star. Yeah. Why did I forget Red Star?
Yeah, I don't know why you forgot Red Star. They were in the Australia Cup.
I caught this season and obviously saw in the cup and spoke to John Kinesi. That's very embarrassing. Anyway, really back to the point here, because this is a really serious thing that's happened. So Matt Sparrow has basically led Fremantle City from the aspiration that they held for literally decades, trying to get out of the state league, has guided them to an incredible season where they would have been in contention but for Kingsway having this absolute behemoth of a team. And Matt Sparrow the whole time was in talks with Bayswater City. And the club fucking, they despise him. They are so mad about this. So the season ends, very successful campaign. We're going to take it to the next level. We are going to become champions of WA. And Matt Sparrow, again, he is probably one of the more organized. He comes with an incredible resume. You know, he very famously would tell everyone at Fremantle City a story about how he scored at Wembley in a playoff when he was playing in the English Football League in like 2006 or 2007. And it just became known that, like, if you were going to sit down and have a beer with Matt Sparrow, you would hear his like detailed recount of the game. I want to say he played for Brighton and Hove Albion, I think it was. Anyway, besides the point, he is someone that I could genuinely see making it over East. And so I think that's why this comes as such a shock to the system, because he did finally take the club to the next level. They would have done anything possible for him. And he's announced that he's at Bayswater City. Bayswater City themselves building up their precinct, trying to get some new sort of up to date facilities and government backing and all this stuff. And they have the appointment of Matt Sparrow on top of that. So yeah, it's a really, really shocking story. Fremantle City's actually were that incensed by the whole situation. They got the last laugh by announcing their new coach, which, Christian, you will be familiar with, Scott Miller.
Scott Miller, wow. There you go. Interesting. Yeah. It's all due respect, Matt. That seems like a prestigious appointment for MPLW.
Sorry, it's not the Scott Miller that coached Newcastle. Scott Miller, who played for Perth Glory.
Who played for Perth Glory? Yes. Yeah. That's Scott Miller. Yes. Okay. Well, still a good
appointment. Deal for Fremantle.
I'm actually sorry, I'm a little bit distracted. I've literally just gone. I'm taking some notes as we're doing this, and my pen has completely flipped out and broken. It's literally half of it has gone flying across the study that I'm sitting in right now.
Yeah.
So that's awesome. But anyway, that is a fascinating story. Just on that, it is. Locally, where I am here in SA, this September period is also, I think we're going to start calling it Silly September, because just the rumors are flying around like crazy
with coaches, at a local and level.
Coaches, players, whatever. Yeah. It's all happening. I'm actually going to take a short break because I need to fix my pen situation. When we come back, we're going to start our deep dives with the Australia Cup quarterfinals. Okay, coming back, and we are going to get into our first topic of this podcast, which is reactions to the Australia Cup quarterfinals. Now, we're going to be doing a little bit of a segment for this, and I'm calling it, I don't really know, I was going to call it Reactionary A-League Takes, but there could be takes for like any of the teams that are left in the Australia Cup. Of course, South Melbourne still being in the Australia Cup and being an NPL team. So I've just called it Reactionary Takes. So very, very creative. Very creative name for this segment. But basically what me and Matt are going to do is go back and forth with what I would classify as overreactions, essentially, to the quarterfinals of the Australia Cup. And if there's anything that's kind of like, particularly from an A-League perspective, okay, yeah, this team, you know, we're going to overreact to this team, or we're going to overreact to this player. And go from there. So I'm hoping to have a bit of fun with this. Matt, you're the guest. You are going to kick this off. So what's your first? Well, we'll probably do like three each. So what's one of your overreactions from the Australia Cup quarterfinals?
Oh, look, obviously when South eventually do win the title, they need to be, you know, admitted with an A-League license. I thought that much was obvious.
Jesus. Just gone straight down the barrel to the heart of. Oh man!
But do I really need to elaborate? I mean, they are Oceania Club of the Century, and they're on their way
I'm laughing because, like, listen, don't get me wrong, that was a fantastic achievement for South Melbourne, but like, it's been like 25 years since South Melbourne were awarded that, and I swear, like, it's the first thing I hear when people talk about South Melbourne, but. Anyway, you were saying.
It's actually funny because when we talk about like historic South Melbourne, when they were essentially the equivalent of Melbourne Victory in that time, like all you have to do is replace the sentence Oceania Club of the Century with "we played against Manchester United in a competitive fixture." And it's like, okay, people get the point. You know what I mean? Yeah. And of course, Ange Postecoglou was coach for that match as well, which has a whole other aura added to it, given what he's gone on to achieve in his career.
Aura, is that the first time Aura has been mentioned on the FPF podcast ever?
Or maybe.
I think so. There we go.
Yeah. But look, obviously, we can sit here and have a laugh about it, but obviously I think, you know, a club of that size going on to achieve, you know, a National Cup title would be very impressive. But obviously, if we want to make this a bit of a lighthearted, jokey segment, it's the perfect kind of thing to start with, yeah.
So, that's not so much a... Is that a take? So the take is if South Melbourne win the Australia Cup, give them the A-League license.
I thought you wanted a light-hearted, humorous take on the situation. I didn't think you actually wanted a genuine opinion.
It should be a genuine opinion as well.
Well, I mean, well, I've still made my genuine opinion in what I've said. I mean, for a club of their size and of their importance to the game, to win the National Cup is a massive achievement, and we should be looking forward to this, you know, potential semi-final in Victoria with a lot of promise.
Yeah. Okay. I'll give one of mine. I'm going to phrase mine as kind of like questions, and then we can kind of talk about them. So first thing, obviously, I was at the Adelaide United Wanderers quarterfinal at Service FM Stadium. So Nicholas Milanovic, are we sure Nicholas Milanovic isn't going to be a contender for the Johnny Warren Medal this season? Like bang, massive bang, like flaming hot
Yeah.
take, putting it out there. What do you reckon?
I just think that the like the Dally M in rugby league, or like the Brownlow in AFL, I think with the Johnny Warren medal, it does favour itself to a certain type of player. It does favour itself to a certain type of position. We're talking about midfielders here. So for someone like Milanovic, who is obviously going to be employing a lot more of an attacking role than someone who's maybe doing a bit more behind the scenes, there maybe is a little bit that's kind of out of whack there in terms of can someone go on and do it. But if I were to think of attacking players that have won the Johnny Warren Medal, Roy Krishna is someone that immediately comes to mind. And does Nicholas Milanovic have a Roy Krishna-esque, you know, arc in him? He absolutely does. So, yeah, I it's something that I definitely look forward to seeing is his impact on the potential rise of that Wanderers team. But we're talking about a team that's got, you know, Wanmatter and some of these other names in it as well. Where there will be a lot of potential to set him up. So yeah, could happen.
Well, my thing watching him was this is a guy who probably should have got his move to Europe. There was a lot of reported interest from Croatia in particular. Seemed like whatever maybe deal or deals were proposed probably fell through, or whatever interest fell through. And I'm just wondering whether there's a bit of a kind of fuck you, I'm going to prove myself again this season, and I'm too good for this league sort of. So I'm just going to basically take it by the scruff of the neck, because it was kind of clear in that game. And I understand what you're saying, Matt. To be fair, we Mata's not ready yet. All other players who could contribute as well. But it felt like there was like this aura, I'm going to use that term again, of like, I'm the main man in this team. I'm going to be leading the line either more as a winger, but I'm going to be like a really big source of goals. And for me, like, could I see Nicholas Milanovic scoring 15 goals and contributing another 5 or 6 assists, having a 20 plus goals and assists season, and leading the Wanderers to like a top four finish? Yeah, I think I could if you ask me right now. So that was kind of my takeaway. Like, I don't know why when I was watching the game, it was just like straight away, it was like, man, Milanovic, there's something here where he's like, he might have like a massive season. So that's my thoughts there. And the other thing as well is like, you know, with the Wanderers, we know like from last year and stuff, like if he can be like the face of essentially a resurgence that gets the Wanderers, yeah, into the top six again, and even a top four, like a home final, then it's going to be massive. So that was my first overreaction. I'm going to throw back to you. Any other thoughts on Milanovic? If not, then feel free to get into your second one.
Yeah, so I mean, we've got two clubs left. And if you don't mind, I know we've kind of done this on an impromptu kind of basis anyway, but
Yes.
given we've given two of the four clubs, so I might as well go next in saying that as far as MacArthur are concerned, sort of, you know, them trying to build on this whole reputation, given, you know, the massive scandal that's happened in the off season, losing senior players. You know, a team that has won this competition before understand the value of what's at play to kind of rebuild their reputation as a franchise. Will MacArthur on the whole be forgiven should they claim a second piece of silverware? And it certainly, I think, becomes a reactionary take when you realize that there are a lot of deeply rooted issues with the attendances and everything like
Wait,
that. But
so do you think so? If MacArthur win their second Australia Cup in 3 years, essentially what we're saying here is the take kind of like MacArthur should be more respected if they win the cup.
I just mean it'll delete a lot of the demons from the whole betting saga. That's basically what I'm saying, is we can actually look forward and look at what this team is again, instead of making them a laughing stock for what's happened. At the end of the day, you know, it's as serious as we've had senior players in our competition arrested by the federal police. I mean, that's something that, you know, is going to tarnish any brand, but MacArthur can come back from this if they come back with the intent of winning silverware. And I think that a lot of people would get the pitchforks out and say, well, they're an absolute joke and there's this and that. But I tell you what, there are times where I look at MacArthur's history and I still respect a lot of what I've seen. And I think one of the biggest things as a takeaway here is Milos Teodosic didn't really have much of a resume. And the fact that they've kind of backed him in and they've seen him maybe falter here or there as a coach, he's still there. For him to, you know, certainly in a post-Dwight York world, to claim that second piece of silverware for that club, that's a massive achievement, one you'd have to be really, really proud of. So I think we can definitely look at taking MacArthur seriously again, you know, Calmania and all that. Still got a decent core of players. So, yeah, that's kind of my view on the situation. Should they overcome South and look at a cup final again?
Yeah, okay. It is quite interesting how MacArthur, you know, for all their faults, could win a second piece of silverware. And, you know, also weirdly, last year, they actually got knocked out in the round of 32 by an NPL team in Campbelltown. So they've just had this kind of topsy-turvy relationship with the cup. But, I mean, you look at the results and stuff, like, they've been quite steady. Like, Oakley, they kept a clean sheet. They scored early. They kind of shut up shop. They're just kind of getting the job done. They had then, on the other flip side, they had a result against Newcastle where they had to come from behind, won like a crazy 7-goal thriller. So, and we know when you've got Yakalis, Sherman, these attacking talents, you know, you're a threat. You're just a threat on any given day. And also, you know, they've had the experience. So when, of course, they won the 2022 Australia Cup, they played Oakley in the semi-final, which was kind of NPL team away, semi-final, hostile environment. They didn't have any issues on that night. If I'm not mistaken, they won 5-2 in that semi-final. So my point is, with particularly the experience these guys still have with the likes of Germain, I don't think they're going to be fazed at all by whatever South Melbourne crowd is going to be kind of greeting them on Sunday either. So, and they've been to a final before of the Australia Cup. So I think, honestly, like, if people... I think most people are leaning towards Melbourne victory, who I'm going to get to in a moment. But yeah, if you're putting your money on MacArthur to take out the Australia Cup, I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. They're probably the second surest bet, I would want to say. But I'm sure there are all these angry, all these, not angry, just kind of moody South Melbourne
people
fans.
Just don't well, sorry, but I know what you're saying.
I just realized. Is this the McFranchise Derby?
It pretty much is. Because with MacArthur, you have an organization, not a team, an organization from top to bottom that people just constantly shit on and want to see fail at every cost because of what they represent. Mm-hmm. In South Melbourne, you know, again, you know, it's just complete opposite end of the spectrum. But I think when I speak for most football fans, and if you picture it like the political scale, this is a dead-eyed centrist, bloody, you know, enlightened centrist take here. But shouldn't we just actually be extremely happy for the success of both the McFranchises of the world and the Oceania clubs of the century? You know, so I'd be happy to see the winner of this. Actually, here's a hot take for you out of nowhere. I want the winner of this semi-final to win the cup.
Okay. Well, that's a prediction.
It is.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Cool.
Yes, a hot prediction. Right. Interesting. Let's also make sure, note to security, can we make sure SMFC Mike does not come into contact with Gino Mara at all on Sunday? Because there could be some violence in that encounter. Anyway, let's move to my next take. So Melbourne victory. Question on Melbourne victory. Are we sure Patrick Osnorbo isn't about to turn this Melbourne victory team into a juggernaut like he did with Melbourne City?
Well, I mean, if that's the question, plain and simple.
Listen, it's an overreaction take on purpose. So obviously everyone straight away is going to go like, well, what are you talking about? Like, they've just played Morton City, Excelsior, and Landon Jaffers. They've played two NPL teams, you know, and all this. Oh, and Spirit as well, NPL team. Like, they haven't even played an A-League team yet, this, that, and the other. But I don't know, man. Like, they're playing a style of football which is very nice. They've got an abundance of attacking talent. Their new Greek striker they've signed, Virgos, is not only scoring already, which is like the biggest like plus for a foreign striker when you sign them in the A-League, but he looks fit. He looks like he wants to be there. And also, I'm looking at Melbourne Victory as a team who made the grand final last year. For me, unjustly, I don't think they really did enough throughout the season to warrant a grand final appearance. But that's the point. They didn't do enough to warrant a grand final appearance. They also took what was the best team in the league all season to extra time in that grand final. And now they've got a manager who is much more attack-minded and who can actually overcome these issues that they've had from last year, where they've had these 1-0 to the 89th minute and then bang, conceded a stupid goal and we just dropped 2 points when that should have been an easy 3 points. I feel like Patrick Osorbo's ability to get a team to essentially stay on message and really execute in a, how do I explain, a ruthless manner. Yeah, a ruthless manner could be something which takes this Victory team into kind of juggernaut territory. That's I'm going to put it out there. But again, I understand counter arguments. What's your thoughts?
Without getting into the weeds of it, right? There's something me and Cody did on the women's pod, you know, a few seasons back, maybe even last season. It all becomes a blur at one point, but we emphasized the ceiling and the floor of each of the teams in the competition. When I look at the appointment of Patrick Osorbo, with how swiftly it was made in lieu of Popovic calling it quits after, you know, losing the fifth grand final, My immediate reaction to that was, okay, it's obviously controversial because of his reason for leaving City, the fact that he was a legend at City, working his way all the way through. But my instinct was just immediately that's such smart recruitment, because the floor you're going to get with an experienced Melbourne Victory team coming off a grand final mixed in with someone who's a proven A-League winning manager, you're going to get a floor of like, oh yeah, they might finish like fifth or sixth at worst. Now, could they self-destruct as equally as much as they could go on to become, you know, a power? Yes. But I think it's fair to say that most people are going to have Melbourne Victory in their top six, and rightly so. Rightly so, with the form they've built, with what's going on behind the scenes, that's a team that's I believe set up for success. So Absolutely. I mean, the appointment of Patrick Osorbo is exactly what that team has needed. And good on Melbourne Victory for seeking that out, regardless of how controversial it was going to be. And here's the thing. If he starts winning with the club, his history with City and the people that have a big deal about it because of the rivalry between the two clubs, they're not going to care. They're going to be...
No one cares. I mean, here's my take on football fans in general. Football fans are loyal until they're not. So,
you're right.
And which is no different to coaches and players. So,
But I also think when it comes to a Sydney FC, a Western Sydney Wanderers, a Melbourne Victory, when we talk about the upper echelon of clubs that we know can comfortably pull like a 30,000 crowd to a single match, when we talk about building Melbourne Victory to their core, where they're winning, where the names in the team are familiar to people, we are talking about a Melbourne Victory that makes the league as a whole a better place to be. That is just a plain and simple fact. And I say this as a Western Australian who, in the early era of the A-League, we despised everything about Melbourne Victory because of this natural rival with, you know, big city Victorians, right? And no doubt in South Australia, people feel exactly the same way. On a cultural blend that goes through sport and elements of culture and politics and whatever it be. And I'm going on a really weird tangent here. But
are we about to talk about Jacinta Allen's time as a Victoria?
what I'm getting at is Melbourne Victory are just the envy of the league when they're firing, when they're at their very best, and they have the platform to be able to do that again. If Patrick Osorbo gets them winning, it's not just the fans that are disillusioned with him who are coming back. It is the potential to get like 25,000 people rocking it Amy Park. That's just plain and simple what it does, and it's a net benefit for the competition. So I think it'd be fair to say it's nice to see Melbourne Victory ticking when they tick along and when they're a good team to watch.
So just quickly, so Dan Andrews versus Jacinta Allen, Premier. No, no, it's not. Okay. I wanted to know what style that
conversation. Dan Andrews was no state daddy, mate. Mark McGowan was.
Okay. Let's not. I wouldn't even know where to start with that conversation because I have such little knowledge. But anyway, we're I'm mindful of time. So the next take is going to come from me. No, is it? No, it's going to come from you. What am I talking about?
We did all four teams. What are you talking about?
We did all four teams that went through. No, we didn't talk about Adelaide United, but also we're doing three takes each. I think we've done two each.
Oh, sorry. I just plain and simply made it. Let's talk about all the different teams. We did South, we did McCarver, we've done Victory.
Okay, so you have not followed the criteria of the segment.
No.
Which is fantastic, but also probably self-inflicted by me given the lack of preparation, lack of timely preparation provided for the podcast. Yep. So I will take that one on the chin. Why don't I just do my next overreaction take? So
yeah, sure.
I'm going to talk about one of the teams which lost actually in the quarterfinals because I think this team is very important to mention for the incredible run that they had. Morton City Excelsior. Now, my take is I think there are there's already one that we know who's going to sign for Western Sydney. That's Ben Holiday. So that's one player we know is going to be a player we're going to talk about for a few years. But like I think there's going to be a legacy with this Morton City team that's going to kind of ripple potentially into the professional games. And And I'm talking about not just Ben Holiday. I'm talking about Zachary Kierpal. I'm talking about Marquez Walters. And I'm also going to extend that to their coach, Cameron Miller, who has clearly shown his tactical aptitude. And even like, although Perth Glory were like, you know, they're early in their preseason and David Zrilic is new at the helm and stuff. Just quickly. David Zrilic is tactically a very, very astute coach. And Cameron Miller, despite going 2-0 down in a big Australia Cup tie, was able to, you know, right the wrongs of that game. And I'm not going to say it's solely down to Cameron Miller's, you know, aptitude as a manager, but I'm saying surely it contributes to it. And this is a guy who beat an A-League women's coach in Michael Matriciani in a round of 32. And not just beat, like, I mean slaughtered. Like 5-1, Campbelltown, who are a pretty decent side in their own right, could not get anywhere near Morton City in that game. And I just think that's a guy we should keep an eye on for an A-League gig down the road in terms of not necessarily head coach, but maybe a part of a coaching staff, as an assistant, something of that nature. So yeah, I think Marquez Walters as well, and even Kierpal, I think are kind of these prime candidates for a potential second division where they're kind of in that in-between level of NPL and A-League. So, yeah, I wanted to talk about them and kind of just give a take that I think we're going to see a ripple effect into the professional game from this Morton City team.
Yeah, it's a pretty hot take, I think, mostly because, you know, this is what the Australia Cup was built to do. And the fact that if this was just a team competing in the Football Queensland structure, the eyeballs on someone like a Marquez Walters, who I was especially impressed with, you know, the tactical nous of Miller, it sort of goes out of mind, out of sight, out of mind. Whereas through the cup competition, their incredible form, the upset results they did achieve, we're immediately looking at a team that we know, has all this talent waiting in the wings that can be pushed up the pyramid. And that's a very, very unique thing to happen in the Australian football pyramid, kind of full stop, right? So I find that especially interesting that they've kind of single-handedly got a lot of people paying attention to Football Queensland when none of us normally kind of would. And that's a really big testament to the team and what they did achieve.
And we didn't mention Adelaide United. Matt, do you have any Adelaide United thoughts? Did you watch their game against the Wanderers? I'm intrigued.
I'm pretty agnostic, knowing that last season was such a big disappointment. I feel like you can't really do a lot wrong to continue on top of a lot of the issues that had carried on from last
season.
Well,
yeah, I think.
I would much rather hear, you know, the thoughts of guys like you and Antonis, knowing that you live and breathe the stuff.
Well, we'll finish with them just quickly, and I won't be long, but the defensive issues don't seem like they're going to go away anytime soon. So you know, if anyone is like expecting Adelaide United to kind of turn into this like really solid defensive unit, I just don't really see it. However, I thought that was their first, if I'm not mistaken, yes, that was their first test against A-League opposition in the Cup. And they kind of passed it with flying colours in terms of their chance creation was really good. They were probably the better team on the night and they deserved the win. And they've also stumbled into this Austin Ayoubi piece of this guy who had an exceptional season at NPL level last year. They brought him in towards the end of last season. Now he's got a full preseason under his belt. And he looks like he's going to be a really key contributor for them next season. So I think that's a benefit of the Australia Cup for the A-League teams, where you get these guys who might be kind of still embedding into their new environment and they can kind of use what is essentially a preseason tournament to get themselves really up to speed, get extra match minutes with their teammates. And that's definitely going to be a big silver lining out of this cup run for Adelaide United, is his form and his ability now to kick on and become a key contributor for the team. So yeah, that's my brief Adelaide United thoughts. Okay. Was there any, I don't think we covered all the four teams that are remaining. Hume City, big shout out to them. Massive, massive run that they went on to make the quarterfinals. We were talking about how Oakley is South Melbourne's kryptonite and Hume's kryptonite is South Melbourne. So I believe South Melbourne beat Hume something like 3 or 4 times this year alone, which is kind of crazy. We're going to take another quick short break, and then after this, we've got national teams to talk about from the Socceroos, a little bit of Matildas, and also a little bit of young Matildas too. So we'll be back right after this quick break. Okay, we're back, and we're going to be shifting our focus now from the National Cup to the national teams. And we're going to start by talking for probably a little bit about the Socceroos, because it's been actually a week since the Socceroos played their second game against Indonesia and drew nil all. So obviously we are a little bit late to the party on this, but I'm sure Matt and myself have got plenty of thoughts that we want to get into about the Socceroos' recent international window. Of course, losing 1-0 to Bahrain and then drawing nil all with Indonesia in Jakarta. So, Matt, I think there's only really one place to start here with this conversation, and it's with Graham Arnold. And I'm literally just going to... I'm sure you've got a whole bunch of thoughts you want to download anyway, but Arnie, should he stay? Should he go? What are your overall thoughts on the picture? How concerned are you about the management and the coaching of this team at the moment?
Yeah, so Paul Williams on the Asian game made probably the best point in all of this that I think really surmises the issue and why people are so annoyed. And it's the fact that we had this whole horrific cycle where we almost didn't make the World Cup in Qatar. Through, you know, just a lack of attacking prowess, which has, you know, been such a long-term problem for the Socceroos. And I guess the issue is that with Arnie's successes, successfully playing that less of an attacking kind of mindset against teams better than us at the World Cup, we've disillusioned into thinking it's a recipe for success in basically every circumstance, only to realize, of course, it's not. There's a reason why we are making such a mess of Asian qualifying with such a structured team. And, you know, when we look at Bahrain as, you know, an attacking team, obviously they do sit back and they gave us the ball and then they were able to kind of have that breakthrough. And if people don't really have to look that far, especially those of us that watch the Asian game a lot, to remember that they did the exact same thing to South Korea. So it was, you know, at the Asian Cup, they topped that group. People forget they top group effort at the Asian Cup. And that situation was staring us in the face that whole time. And for whatever reason, Arnie decides to have that more pragmatic approach in the second game, notwithstanding that Bahrain are a team that can really basically be the total kryptonite to his game plan to begin with. And look, they were very, very lucky to score in the circumstances that they did. You don't really, there's no other way to say that we're extremely unlucky. But we shouldn't be talking about this as though it's a matter of luck. It's not a matter of luck. It was a dismal performance that we ended up getting punished by. And that's something that you can't take away from this situation and think, okay, well, we know Arnie has the recipe for success. He kind of does, but he only does when we're playing a big European opponent, and we're playing the total opposite of that right now. And the lack of that ability, and almost like out of shame, out of guilt, he ends up playing the better 11 against Indonesia, as if to say, of course I can play attacking football. Well, no, this is not how these things work. And so people are rightfully pissed off. But I also want people to remind themselves that if we finish as low as fourth, which is probably almost certainly still going to happen, that we'll finish in the top four. I mean, it's not going to be so dismal as to the fact that we're down in the rungs of the table with China. If we finish fourth in this group, we're still going to another round where we're going to play opponents, you know, potentially even weaker than China, right? We are going to make this World Cup. With the expanded format, it's not even a question. It's just like, it's not even, we're not going to qualify. And Arnie will find a way to get through if he stays. That's all the more reason for, in the long term, the FA to just, you know, basically be, have whispers in his ear that, oh, you know, you might want to do this or you might want to do that. But basically just to say that you've still got the job as long as you just get that one fundamental job done. The other side of it is, if we actually look at the next eight games remaining in the cycle and actually do look at making some changes, what does that look like in an expanded World Cup format where we're not just going to be playing Denmark and France? We are actually probably going to be playing some teams who are similar to Bahrain, who are similar to Indonesia, who are similar to China. And that becomes a different situation.
That's a good point.
I think there's a lot of facets to this. And I don't necessarily think the FA are going to rush into a decision, which people have to be very mindful of, given the dynamics of the World Cup cycle. But there is a lot at play here where they can make the change. And if they are responsive enough to what's going wrong with Graham Arnold, then that change will definitely be made. It's just a sense of the people in control really having the timing right and having the sensibility and understanding when does the situation become so bad that it needs change.
So I've got many, many thoughts on all of this. I was unable to put them into a little article after the Bahrain game because I was actually there covering that one. But then the Indonesia game came along, and some of those thoughts could have been double downed on. I could have doubled down. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Sorry. And some of those thoughts could have been altered slightly too. So, firstly, I would be shocked if Graham Arnold was sacked at any point of this qualifying cycle. So there's that to begin with, which is also why I think he feels maybe a bit more freedom after two games to start essentially calling out the players in the media, which he basically did after the Indonesia game. The other thing is, so Matt, your points around how Australia set themselves up. So I don't think Graham Arnold doesn't set Australia up in an attacking fashion in these games. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think the issues are that we lack the creativity to break down stubborn defensive low blocks units, whatever you want to describe them as. So there's that, which is it is slightly a personnel issue. Personnel issues which are inflicted by Graham Arnold because of his selections, for sure. But also personnel issues because we also lack certain personnel that is required for these sort of games. Now, on the playing style thing, and it's linked to selection as well. So if I'm Graham Arnold, I can't... So I can play like a really attacking, like basically kind of what we saw against Indonesia, like two up front, basically two wingers, two strikers, like it's really attacking. The setup is kind of gung-ho. And I can play that way every game, but I know that when we play a France at a World Cup, and if we try and do that, we're going to get thrashed 6-0. And I know that for sure. Or I can play the more pragmatic style in the big games. And then basically when we come up against those smaller Asian sides or any other smaller teams that we might come up against, weaker teams in other tournaments, I'm essentially going to have to concoct one-off game plans where we can be dominant in possession and try and create chances. The problem with that is, as he has mentioned himself, let's go to the Bahrain game. I think it's likely that the Socceroos basically had two sessions in the lead up to that game. All the players are coming in from different parts of the world. And of course, it's no different to many other national teams. However, we do have to remember that Bahrain did have 10 days in the Gold Coast before that game. They were very much acclimatized to what was happening. But I think the problem is that you can't prepare for an opponent like Bahrain when for literally you're only going to work on your patterns in possession and the way you're going to attack for like half a session. Like that's actually the reality. And I think the other thing with this, and I'm going to cut to the chase, and like I can't believe I'm literally coming across like a Graham Arnold defender, like literally what the fuck, to be honest with you. But let's be honest here, like Graham Arnold Australia could come back from this, finish second, and like get a result in Japan or something, let's just say, for argument's sake, which is possible because Australia, the Socceroos have matched up really well against teams that are technically better than them, because we know that they are very proficient at sitting back and playing on the counterattack. You referenced that South Korea game. We want to talk about that South Korea game. That was on the players not taking their chances. Like, there's no other way you can look at that game. I'm sorry. So, for example, the only one you could say is maybe he shouldn't have brought on Lewis Miller, who, of course, made those mistakes which led to South Korea winning the game. But my point is that, like, it feels like we're getting to the spot where it doesn't matter what Graham Arnold does, people are still going to be pissed off, which basically means, so basically you just don't like Graham Arnold, okay, which is fine. No one said you have to like the guy, but can you please, when you're assessing the performance of the national team, separate whatever club bias you have, i.e. if you're a Melbourne Victory fan, separate that from, am I letting my bias towards this guy used to coach Sydney FC, he was a wanker when he coached Sydney FC in my eyes, so fuck him when he coaches Socceroos. Can we separate that from actually what is he doing tactically? Like, what is he actually trying to do? What is his selections? How is he approaching that? And let's just talk about that solely. Because for me, I just see a lot of comments where it's like, oh, Graham Arnold has no idea, this, that, and the other. It's like, well, don't get me wrong, Graham Arnold's made mistakes. Let's not beat around the bush. In the Bahrain game, he made several mistakes. But like, this is also a guy who took us to the round of 16 of the World Cup. Like, I think he has some idea what he's doing, with all due respect. Like, he's a guy who took a Central Coast Mariners team to you know, be one of the best teams in Australia for many years, you know. And he obviously turned that Sydney FC team into a juggernaut when he was there, albeit they were, you know, quite a loaded and stacked team. So when I look, now going away from that, when I look at, okay, what's Graham Arnold doing wrong? Okay, so there are a few things. There are certain players, so the Harry Suters of this world, the Jackson Irvines of this world, listen, on certain days, we love them. They are, you know, we reference Harry Suter's tackle against Tunisia all the time. Jackson Irvine, we love as a character, as a personality, absolutely brilliant, right? But when it comes to, we're playing Indonesia and they've got two banks of five, we're playing Bahrain, they've got basically a bank of six and a bank of four, they're that defensive. Those guys are two guys, for example, who just shouldn't play in those games. Like, I know that, like, that sounds maybe ridiculous, but that's the reality. And I think what the problem is here is Graham Arnold's got this conundrum where, because he's so attached to those two guys in particular, for example, he feels like, well, I have to play them because I don't want them to lose any confidence in me. There's that. And also, like, we've got to keep a consistent 11 week in, week out, every game. Whereas I think maybe for the Socceroos, it might actually be better to adapt to different opponents, be a bit more flexible. And I think the issues are actually more maybe with selection as opposed to tactical, is kind of my overall takeaway with this. So, like, the Irvines, the Suters of this world, for example, but like the Bahrain game, and Matt, I'll throw it back to you in a moment. I know I've been talking for quite a bit, but so the Bahrain game, like, it was pretty clear after 30 minutes, like, Australia have to go to two strikers. Like, fuck it. Like, you need to just open things up, right? Like, we've seen the script before against these teams. We know, like, you know, I'm hearing a lot of people complain about play acting and stuff. It's like it's been any different any of the other fucking 90 times that we've played any of these smaller Asian nations. Like, we know that they're going to come to Australia. They're going to park the bus. They're going to time waste. Like, this isn't news. You know what I mean? And if anything, and Graham Arnold seemed pretty disappointed after the game, like, I was kind of disappointed in the players for actually being goaded into it, like, in the Gold Coast. And it's like, guys, come on. You've been a part of qualifying cycles. We know what they're going to do. So if we know that, and this is now on Graham Arnold, if we know that basically going with one striker playing a really kind of a bit more of a conservative 3-2-5 shape that Australia were playing in possession, you know, let's just change it after 30 minutes. Like, chuck Nestor on after 30 minutes. Like, go to two strikers. Who cares? Play a front four, you know? And what's the worst that's going to happen? Like, you know, Matt, I know we've got to give credit to Bahrain for sure, but I will say this, like, it was lucky that they did score against Australia because they had absolutely no right to score in that game. They had a right to get a result, don't get me wrong, but they definitely didn't have a right to score. That came out of nothing. Even being in the stadium was kind of like, what the hell? How the hell have Bahrain actually scored? So I think for Graham Arnold, he mentioned after the Indonesia game, I think he mentioned something along the lines of, like, I've got a lot of thinking to do and stuff. Whatever that thinking is, I think some of it needs to be, listen, if China at home's next, right? If that game after 20 minutes, we're not creating anything and it's just looking really fragile and stale, like, I just need to go for it. Like, we've got no, like, play two strikers. Fuck me, play three strikers if that's what's needed. Like, who cares? Like, what are you going to lose? Like, at the end of the day, you know, and like you said, Matt, Australia are not going to finish any lower than fourth. You're right. Like, it's just, I don't see that. Maybe just the doomsday scenario is they finish fifth in the group, right? Absolute doomsday scenario. Like, they're not going to finish bottom. In fact, I think China are probably going to finish bottom of this group. Like, you're probably going to mention them briefly. Like, they look absolutely honking. But like, if that's the case and you're so sure that you're at the absolute minimum going to get through the next round, then really there shouldn't be any sort of cautious approach when it comes to team selection and the way the team is set up. But I think what people are confusing is just because Graham Arnold sets the team up in a certain way doesn't mean that he's not going out to be the team that tries to play attacking, that tries to be a possession-based team. Like, I think his intentions are not to, oh, we're just relying on set pieces. I think that's how the performances are manifesting themselves. That's for sure. Don't get me wrong. But I don't think that's his intention. I will defend him on that. So lots to think about, Matt. I've had that's felt like a fucking 6-7 minute spiel. But yeah.
Probably 3 points that I want to raise.
Yeah.
Just to kind of wrap this conversation up. And I think the first two kind of combine with each other. Something that you mentioned about he's sort of sticking with favorites. And I think that sticking with favorites is intrinsically inclined with his system, right? How did Aaron Moy, Tom Rogic, Jackson Irvine, how did these guys really mold into becoming the core of the Socceroos? And it was because we always played with the kind of deep-lying playmaking six. And then, you know, the big frames of a lot of those defensive players to move the ball around. Like, it is the same static Socceroos that we've been watching for literally over a decade now, right? It is a very, very similar plan. And so he's sticking towards a stubbornness of that system because he's seen it work, and he's seen it work, you know, to get the Socceroos to a World Cup and then work at a World Cup. And because of that stubbornness, that's where the lack of I guess you could say it two ways. It's they're overly structured, and then there's the lack of subsequent change and adaptability that comes with it, right? And it just causes this toxic cycle where he sticks by the system and the system works, and then the same old tired players, and I shouldn't say that of someone like Jackson Irvine, but there are situations, especially early in a cycle like this, where he kind of does look really kind of offish and you know, just someone who really could be better off utilized in a completely different way, or just not utilized at all, to your point. So I just think that there's a stubbornness there where Graham Arnold is sticking with a system that he has seen in real time work, and then the problematic results are coming as a result of that. But there's one more thing on Graham Arnold that you touched on right at the start of your conversation that really shouldn't go amiss when it comes to the conversation of will he get sacked. I don't think the FA have the heart on merit to look at his on-pitch issues, to look at a window like this and go, you need to be taken out of the job. At the end of the day, he's someone that has sacrificed literally decades of his life to this cause. He is someone that has had success for this cause. He is someone that always acts with the right intentions. but it's his conduct. It's him. It's the way he is starting to act in the press. It's his conduct that is setting the precedent for the FA to look at him and go, okay, we're starting to have second thoughts about you. And that's where, like, that's where I become annoyed with Graham Arnold, because it's like, so many people think so fondly of you for the way that you've given to the game. So many people think so fondly of you of what you achieved not even 2 years ago yet. Do you know what I mean? Like, that was still so recent and still so fresh in our minds. And to compound that, we have a problematic window where everyone has the pitchforks out. And what does he do? He starts acting like a dickhead and saying things like that. That is what is going to get you sacked, Graham. So,
I think, so just like a few more minutes on this. What about the question of, like, do we have the cattle? Because, so here's the thing. Graham Arnold with that squad, in the two games, he purposely went for more wingers because I guess his thinking was basically what we need to try and do is create 2v1 scenarios to try and break down this low block. But more to the point, because it's going to be so tight and the area is going to be so congested, we're not going to be able to maybe play through really any sort of spaces at all. So we're going to need basically Craig Goodwin, Nestoria Nkunda, Awa Mabil, someone of this nature to beat the opposing defender 1v1. To create space that way. That was essentially his overall thought, it felt, from those two games. Now, I don't think there's anything really wrong with that approach. And then the thing is, like, I thought Nestoria Nkunda looked definitely against Indonesia quite good. I think Craig Goodwin in the first game looked good and he shouldn't have been taken off. I think in the second game, though, Craig will probably, you know, admit himself that he could have done more. But Martin Boyle looked terrible against Bahrain. Like, terrible. Like, let's not beat around the bush. Awa Mabil started okay in the first 5 minutes against Indonesia. Then I swear every time the ball went into him, he lost it straight away. Like, and these are the types of things where I think Graham Arnold is looking at it, and the reason why he's airing that frustration is because they're going, well, you're having a go at me for we're not creating chances or whatever, but the players are getting in the positions potentially to make a difference, and particularly the more experienced ones are not. So that's where he's going. And I reckon when he went to the media afterwards and he kind of said, like, essentially, like, I can't do it for them, he was kind of saying, hey, Awa Mabil, step up. Hey, Martin Boyle, wake up. Hey, you know, maybe Mitch Shuke as well, take your chances. Like, you know, and I'm just I'm not, this is my perspective, this is talking from Graham Arnold's perspective. That's what it felt like to me. And also, like, let's be honest, like, the Bahrain game, like, definitely didn't deserve to win that. We were awful. The Indonesia game, like, I reckon if you play that game another 9 times, like, the Socceroos probably do score and win, like, 1 or 2 nil. Like, we had plenty of chances in that game. I don't think I had, there was no issue with, from my point of view, of any Graham Arnold criticism after the Bahrain game. But I felt after the Indonesia game, it was just a pile on of sort of, like, hang on a minute, like, I know you can't really look at the games in isolation because they are linked in one window, but, like, they are different performances where Australia were much better going forward against Indonesia. Nestoria Nkunda has a strike which hits the post. If that goes 1 inch to the left, Australia take a 1-0 lead. Like, they're probably winning 3 or 4 nil. Like, I went into the Indonesia game honestly thinking, like, shit, 80,000, these guys might actually play a little bit on the ball too. Like, this is going to be a tough game. Like, I don't even know if we're going to be able to control this game. And to be honest, we totally controlled that game. So, like, I don't think, like, that was unfair, that second result, in my opinion, to blame that mainly on Graham Arnold. I felt his comments after the second game were more justified because the players, you know, should have taken their chances, but you should never do that as a coach anyway, regardless. So there's also that.
It just doesn't help the situation.
It just doesn't help the situation. And that's the problem, right? And also when we've seen, like, Ernie Merrick previously after the Asian Cup, a lot of people look over this, but after the Asian Cup, Ernie Merrick, like, came out and basically said, we don't have the cattle. Like, in more or less different words, in an article with Sydney Morning Herald, he kind of said that. So, like,
do you want me to touch on that?
You can very briefly for 60 briefly. Seconds.
I'll say this. I think in a mid-2010s situation, I can understand where that situation holds up. And look at the 2014 World Cup squad and you kind of understand the issue. Look at, in the build-up to the 2018 World Cup, who we were looking at as potential future Socceroos. There's a problem. But I'm sorry, in terms of the numbers that we have and where the players and coaches are all going with their career, Australian football was actually in an incredibly healthy place. And I disagree with that. I think under the right system, you can get an Australian football team ticking. I have to go so far as to say people really forget what it was like in like 2016, 2017 era. We were literally talking about like freaking Andrew Naboo serious. Chris Economides scored against Oman in the warm-up game for the 2019 Asian Cup, and he was supposed to be like someone who could be an up-and-coming soccer realm. Come on, guys. Come on. Look at it now with Yangi and bloody someone like a Cameron Devlin or a Josh Nisbet. I mean, come on, the future is just so much brighter.
That was another one. Like, you just mentioned Josh Nisbet. Like, I think it was clear in the Indonesia game, like, okay, so why didn't we see Josh Nisbet in the Bahrain game? So, like, that's but that kind of comes back again to...
I don't know why I randomly said Cameron Devlin. I was just immediately thinking of all the good guys, the good four that went to Scotland. But there's a lot of them. There's a lot of them.
Oh, yeah. There's a shit ton. Nisbet is an example. Like, there's a guy who can break a game open. Like, there's a guy who can receive in between lines against a low block. He's perfect. So, like, maybe part of Graham Arnold's thinking going into the next window is, okay, against China, like, if things aren't working out, okay, a Nisbet-type player is what we need. Like, that's what we need. Or, you know what? Like, but my point is earlier about, like, Irvine is, okay, hey, Jacko, like, we need you for Japan away. Like, that's the game where we need you. Like, we're going to be defending. We're going to play on the counter. We need you to make tackles and to be solid defensively. Save yourself for China. Make sure you're absolutely fit and raring to go because you're going to come off long travel from Germany anyway, right? Mm. Save yourself for Japan away. China will be fine. We've got enough quality as it is to beat them at home. And also, mate, with all due respect, your traits, you're not going to say this to him, obviously, but your traits maybe aren't as well suited to a low block that China are probably going to pose in that game. So I think...
Score a single goal at the Asian Cup, that's the kind of game they're going to play.
Yeah, and I think the main takeaway for Graham Arnold just has to be, I need to loosen the shackles on selection. And that's what I mean. One thing I will say just on that, last thing... because we're this conversation is obviously, as expected, getting a little bit long. But like the Chichardi one, for example, again, people are like, why is Chichardi playing at right back? I mean, I'm sorry. Like, Lewis Miller got injured on the flight over. Nathaniel Atkinson wasn't playing. That's why he wasn't selected. Gethin Jones is injured. And with all due respect, like, you know, meh. And the other thing is, okay, so if he's not going to play Chichardi at right back, so you want Thomas Deng to play at right back? Because that's the only other option in the squad. And I don't think you're going to get any attacking input from Thomas Deng, with all due respect. Like, this guy's a centre-back naturally. So this is the type of stuff where people are looking at things and they're just going like, oh, he needs to do this, he needs to do this. Hang on a minute. Actually look a little bit deeper. Think about the football perspective, the tactical perspective of why the decision was made. And I think you'll find in some cases, not all, definitely not all, but in some cases there are some actual logical reasons to them.
Yeah. I mean, and then just one more point that I want to close on. Right back has been our problem position going back to like 20.
I know. It's so funny. Like, remember like Josh Risden starting in the 2018 World Cup? I know.
I'm about to do a big thing on that, so we can't talk about. Mate, I'm going down to Bunbury for fuck's sake. You can't talk about that.
No. I meant in respect
just in terms
to
of the stocks.
No. Like I mean, okay, let's compare like the ceiling of Josh Risden's career to Luke Wilshere's career, like as an example, obviously, right? Yeah, okay. So obviously Josh Risden at a point in time was still a very capable player, of course. Yeah. You were saying?
Well just that's what I mean. Like, okay, yeah. Josh Risden starting at the 2018 World Cup. But then, you know, the 2018 World Cup was the same time we just randomly decided to bring Ferran Karadžić out of nowhere. And respect to him, I think he still had a pretty good career. I think he still contributed to the core as well. But that just goes to show how desperate we were for right back positions. And after Risten, it was fucking Ryan Grant, who was already on a decline at Sydney FC. Ryan Grant scored against Vietnam, who qualified for 2022. That's how bad the stocks were.
Didn't Ryan Grant was like frisky at the 2019 Asian Cup, wasn't he? from memory, like he was kind of
what a time
forward.
To be alive. What a time to be alive.
Interesting time. Okay, really quickly, prediction: China, Japan. How many points are Australia getting from the two games?
Look,
just like don't even just how many
four.
Four. Okay. So a win against China and a draw in Japan is what you're saying. No, you're actually saying a draw against China, but then a win away to Japan.
Christian, do you know how old we were the last time the Socceroos beat Japan?
Was I born? That's the question.
We both would have been in primary school, is more the point.
Yeah. Sure. It's insane. Yeah. Absolutely insane. Okay. Okay. Some women's national teams stuff now. We're quickly just going to, because that was announced today, so we'll give our brief thoughts. So Tom Samani is the new interim coach of the Matildas. I don't really think there's much kind of to say around this. It seems like a pretty straightforward sort of interim appointment. A guy who's been not just in the job before, but is been heavily involved in domestic women's football in Australia for quite a while now, knows the system very well. What's your overall initial reaction to seeing that today?
Yeah, you are bringing the late 2000s, early 2010s era of the Matildas into the modern behemoth Matildas by having Tom Samani overlook this. And all I'll say is, ahead of the Asian Cup, that's perfect, just to get that insight from him. I mean, he won't really be in the job for very long. I don't even know what sort of fixtures they'll be playing before an appointment is made anyway, if any. They'll probably play a few random friendlies here or there. Obviously, they're scheduled to play Chinese Taipei in preparation for the Asian Cup. A lot of controversy about, you know, they're not even really a strong enough opponent to be playing, only to remember that the Asian Cup is, you know, a 12, potentially 16-team tournament where the depth falls off a cliff. So people just got to see it for what it is. Tom Samani, exactly who you want for that situation, because he was around when we could win Asian Cups.
When, what did you say? I didn't even get that.
He was around when we could win Asian Cup. We still have not won that competition, given how tin pot it is, since 2010. How is that possible?
Always laugh when you use the term tin pot. Such a great adjective, tin pot. I think he knows the player pool as well, coming through quite well, right? So if there was any sort of inkling for him to, you know, work maybe closely in this period with like someone like Leah Blaney and the young Matildas, like, you know, he's got that connection there. He's been a massive part of the Wanderers program for a few years now. We've seen that, you know, last year, the fruits of that with the Wanderers having probably... Their best season on record in the dub. That's what it felt like.
Came out of nowhere, really.
Sophie Harding.
It pains me to say, but it did really all change that night in Perth when she scored that opening goal, and they never really looked back. And there was questions about Robbie Hooker's appointment. And I'm having a PTSD episode. So you need to.
Yeah. You are veering off into dub talk. I'm going to reel you back in. So we're still going to stay on like on a women's football vibe though. So Young Matildas, they did not have a good campaign in the Under 20s World Cup in Colombia. No points from the three games, lost each game 2-0, very similar in the way kind of each game played out. So if anyone wants to go and read about this a little bit more in depth, Matt did write a bit of a review, his thoughts on the campaign. You can go check it out on frontpagefootball.net. But I'm basically going to get Matt to explain those thoughts a little bit more here. So Matt, what was your overall takeaway from the Young Matildas and their campaign?
There's a long conversation to have around the direct comparison between the 22 generation that were in Costa Rica and this 24 generation that were in Colombia. Make no mistake of it, this 24 generation, in terms of where the squad are playing, how many minutes they're getting, how successful they are in the roles they're playing, it is a better team. I don't want to disrespect the Hannah Lowry's and the Sarah Hunters of the world, because they are incredible players in their own right. But 24, you know, the names kind of roll off a bit better. Someone like Naomi Chinima had already been playing so successfully in Melbourne City, gets a move to Perth Glory, where she can probably be, you know, a more influential starting player. just that kind of influence of these are girls that have actually been playing senior minutes longer than what the generation did in 22. Generation in 22 had it far harder coming up against Brazil and Spain than this 24 generation did against, Brazil and Mexico. And I think that the national curriculum of tactics and how we get our youth teams to set up in line with the fact that the senior teams have all of their issues going up with the tactics and how they set up. I just look at this and I'm just so unbelievably baffled. How does a team that is really packed to the brim, full of senior A-League women players, not score a goal at a tournament where they have Mexico and Cameroon in their group? It's pretty disgusting. And you could be so harsh as to just straight up call them shit because they were.
Some people have misconstrued your article to mean that you were calling them shit, which I did not think you were at all. If anyone actually bothered to click on the article and read it,
the headline was very confronting, and it was designed to be because they how traumatized and how I made the whole Ollie Bruce qualifying for the Olympics my whole fucking personality for like three whole months, and the way that fell on its ass. I almost feel more insulted by this because that team went from beating France.
You feel insulted by the result. Sorry, just the way you described it was funny.
The thing is, like, we have to work beyond our means doing this whole journalism thing, right? And getting up in the early hours of the morning to watch these teams is a big personal commitment. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to shy away from the language I use. Yeah. I'm just straight up not. Yeah. We saw an Oli Roos team beat France and then fall flat on their ass against Jordan. It was that was personally insulting. This is a team of players that we have seen for 9 months on end play incredible football and just fall flat against, against Cameroon. Like, what is going on? Cameroonian women's football at the senior level has barely existed. But I was tame in the article because the one thing I took away from it was in relation to their A-League careers, the players are going to be better because of this. And you look at the whole picture. Why does youth football exist? Youth football doesn't exist for results. It exists for development. This tournament developed those girls. It did its job. But I also look at it from the perspective of why do Australian national teams just let us down all the time? It's annoying.
Yeah, I think a couple of points you made in your article was one main point which I thought was really interesting. So I can't remember which game it was. You're gonna have to remind me where Carly Johnson missed the penalty. Which one was it?
Mexico.
Yeah. And I think the main lesson that the young Matildas learned from the tournament was that the game's about moments, and if you don't take yours, you get punished for it. And that's kind of what you were explaining in the article.
Yeah.
And you were kind of saying like, basically, that's a really good learning for these girls to actually have at this age. So, but my question, and I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit here, and you're already like not happy anyway. So, like, this is it's overall a negative conversation. However, I think we should stress here that
positive.
Yeah, no, I think we should stress here that me and Matt aren't just going out of our way essentially here to just shit on some results that we've just seen on Twitter, right? Like, basically, people want to do when like the Joeys lost to Solomon Islands in the first game. So I haven't even watched the highlights. Like, let me just like crap on the Joeys. Like, we're not doing that. Matt's actually watched the games here. But what I want to mention is, like, you mentioned the senior experience that a lot of those players already have. So that's why I'm just kind of... So I'm looking at that and thinking, well, hang on a minute. If they've got senior experience playing in a league, which is more than adequate in the dub, then why haven't they been able to... Right? Like, bring that experience into that tournament. So how come because we're saying they're taking learnings to build their experience away from it, but shouldn't the inverse have happened where they're actually bringing the experience to the tournament?
This is the exact reason I bring up the national football curriculum and how our youth teams approach playing at tournaments. I think it's actually tactical nous that's let them down. And that becomes especially upsetting when me and Cody were talking about Leah Blaney becoming the Matildas coach. Do you know what I mean? So it's her adaptation of how an Australian football team wants to set up at a tournament like this that's probably become a bit of an undoing in that respect. But I don't want to look too far into that again, because players are used to adapting to playing for the national team and playing for their club in a different role. I think that's a pretty universal concept as well. So I don't want to be too harsh on it. I just think that the whole system needs a bit of a refresh in terms of when we're going to these situations and we have teams that can beat France. You know, again, I'm sorry, but I am going to bring that Oli Roos result up all the time, because literally, how did we beat France and fail to beat fucking Jordan? Do you know what I mean? but honestly,
it's gonna be 2028, and Matt's gonna be like, and Oli Roos actually made the Olympics this time, and Matt's still gonna be like, how the fuck did we beat France and not beat Jordan?
Anyway, it actually ties into the Arnie conversation. It does. Because the issue is we can actually set up better against teams above our pay grade. Although specifically in the example of the U20 Matildas, that wasn't even really the case, because I still think that when we faced someone of Linda Caicedo's quality in the first game, she's still young enough for the 20s, of course, got slaughtered. So like even trying to play the defensive, trying to be more pragmatic didn't even really work out. In that sense, the campaign was really a disaster. But our youth teams are going into it with the Graham Arnold mentality. And that's ultimately where we come unstuck.
Okay. Let's finish up. And we're going to finish this very quickly, Matt. We're not going to take long on this. Australia Cup semi-final predictions. So first up, Saturday night, Melbourne V3, Adelaide United, original rivalry. Who you got?
Yeah, well, obviously, we'll be preoccupied with a very special event earlier that day as well. Yes, as I said, I'm probably the one Australian football fan/personality that doesn't care. But let's go victory 2-1 in extra time.
I can't believe.
Victory
2-1 in extra time. Interesting. Okay.
Melbourne. Yeah,
because it's in Melbourne. Yeah, it's at Amy Park. And it's actually, honestly, just quickly with the scheduling of it, it kind of works out if you want to go to the Geelong-Brisbane game at the G, and then you want to just walk across the bridge, or is it a bridge? Yeah, I think so, to Amy Park, then at 7 to watch the football. It kind of works out. But anyway,
if it was like a Collingwood or a Hawthorn or a club like that playing, like, yes, but because it's Geelong, the dynamics
is a little
different.
I know. See, if it was Collingwood, isn't there like a lot of... Isn't there...
Yeah, just Sharon talk.
Yuck. Okay. What am I doing? You mentioned... What did you mention about the...
It's in Melbourne.
Before that, you said like, hey, you didn't care. And I'm just kind of like, aren't you seeing this as like a perfect little appetizer for the A-League season? We've got an original rivalry at Amy Park. Could get 20,000 or something. Who knows? You know?
Yeah. Look, yes. But again, because we are obviously going to be interstate for a very special event, we'll be distracted anyway. That was my mindset.
Yeah.
And as I said, for the storylines with South, for the storyline with MacArthur, far more focused on that second semi-final, just the way I've viewed it.
Yeah, I'm going to go victory 2-0 to win in normal time. So, yeah, I think we've both got victory in the final. Okay, South Melbourne, MacArthur, quick.
Yeah. South probably have it in them to dig in, play a good defensive game. We know that when MacArthur have come up against MPL sides, they've swept them aside and been able to really just kind of mature into the game. If MacArthur get a goal in, let's say, the first half, they probably go on to win it. If there's a bit of late drama going on, which South have certainly been known for their theatrics, I reckon the game could go to extra time. For the purpose of fun, I will say the game does go to penalties. And Philip Curto will score the winning penalty for the Bulls.
Okay. All right, then. That's right. Listen, I said the other game would be normal time, so I reckon I'll do an extra time prediction for this one. I hate Quintas Ball. I think it's gross. I will never root for that style of football to progress, to be brutally honest with you. Even though, no, in all seriousness, it would be unbelievable to see a South Melbourne V3 Grand Final. I do think, though, South have been, I don't want to say lucky, I think that at a certain point, when you kind of keep some results out of your ass in extra time a little bit, like they did against Olympic FC, like they did against Hume. And it's not like they didn't deserve it. I just think the nature of the results means they might it might catch up to them. And I also think MacArthur have the capability to kind of kintas a little bit and actually kind of defend for periods and kind of frustrate South at times. We actually saw MacArthur do that really well in the A-League last year. So I'm going to go MacArthur to win 2-1 in extra time in that one. So I'm saying a victory MacArthur final. Although, of course, like the limbs side of me is definitely rooting for a South victory grand final. That would be absolutely fascinating to witness. Okay, Matt, any parting thoughts before we wrap it up?
Enjoy yourselves over the next couple of weeks of football, and yeah, hopefully we get a good cup final.
Yep, we'll have the Australia Cup final coming soon. Then, like I said at the start, we're only a month away from the A-League men's season kicking off too. I think I've mentioned it on the previous pods, but we are doing just every fortnight for the off-season at the moment. Come a month's time, we'll be going back to the usual weekly FPF podcast. So very much looking forward to it. That's all from us. Thanks for joining us again. I know it's been another elongated podcast, but we've covered a lot of different topics. I'm hoping you've gotten something out of it, found our insights interesting in one way or another. That's going to be that for this episode of the FPF podcast. We'll see you in a fortnight.